Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to this, the latest episode of the Lizelle Wellbeing Show. Thank you very much for joining. And I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Lucy Pollock here today to have a conversation about something that lots of us are sometimes reluctant or even a bit scared to talk about, and that is aging. Now, Lucy trained in Cambridge and at St. Bart's Hospital and went on to specialise in caring for the elderly and the frail. During her 20 years as a consultant, she has become a trusted go-to expert when it comes to living and ageing with dignity. She's now based in Somerset. Her extensive experience of caring for the elderly has led her to write an honest, compassionate and sometimes very funny book, answering the questions about aging that we are often too afraid to ask. Her book is called The Book About Getting Older, and it recognises a problem with how we relate to and look after the frail and the elderly, and reframes the whole aging process as something to be celebrated. It's not something that we often get the opportunity to talk frankly about, so I'm really thrilled to introduce Lucy and excited to hear what you think about our chat. So let me know on Instagram after you have listened, and without further ado, let's get right into the episode. So Lucy, welcome to the podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you here. This is such a timely conversation to be having. Thank you for giving up your time, because I know you are still very much a practicing doctor in the thick of it. So we're really fortunate that you've given up your time. Thank you.
Liz, thank you. It's a real pleasure, a real honour to be here.
Oh, well, you're very kind. And what I'd love to know before we get into talking about your work with the frail and the elderly is really how that all happened. What was your journey as a young medical student and as a young doctor?
Okay, I knew I was going to do medicine from a very early age. I had both of my parents were doctors, and it becomes an inescapable destiny for some of us. And then I started my training once I'd qualified, and I did lots of different medical specialties, as you do. And you rotate from one to another. And I was very lucky. I enjoyed them all. I enjoyed lots of different specialties. And I really did not know what I was going to end up doing. I knew I was going to be a physician rather than a surgeon. I definitely wasn't any good at the surgery. But I wasn't at all sure. And then I went for a meeting with the person who ran our training. And he was fantastic. And he listened to what I was interested in. And there was a long pause. And then he said, Lucy, I'm sorry. I hope you won't be offended, but I think you should do geriatric medicine. And I knew immediately, I thought, I don't know why I hadn't thought of that before. Of course I'm going to do geriatric medicine. It's a fantastic specialty. Yeah. So she said it, I knew that was what I needed to do. And I got myself a registrar training post in geriatric medicine. And I haven't really stopped since.
So why was there potential for you to be offended? Is it seen as a bit of a sort of Cinderella specialty?
It has been in the past. And one of the joys of having been a geriatrician for the last quarter of a century or so is watching it blossom as a specialty and come into its own. And it was interesting, in the early days, geriatric medicine attracted a disparate group, and it still does, but a lot of the people that were interested were very clever and very interesting people, and they were a little bit different from a lot of other specialists. And I'd quite like to think that they still are. I think it has become a specialty that more and more people realise is important and interesting. The science behind it has blossomed. Mm. There's a huge amount of science behind our practice now. And yet it retains the absolute essence of medicine in terms of being about human beings, about real life. Mm. And that combination is unbeatable. And it attracts young doctors in droves now. It's a really competitive specialty. Mm. And some of my young doctors and the best of them go into geriatric medicine.
And when we talk about geriatric medicine, what's the definition? Who do you see and what would they be presenting with?
So that's a good question. We don't define geriatric medicine by age, and we define it by need in almost every department in the UK. And it's really hard to say who is it that needs to see a geriatrician. So GPs often have a good feel for the patients of theirs who might mostly are older. Not everybody is older. Occasionally I see people in their 60s who need to see a geriatrician. But what they do have in common is they tend to have problems that are complicated and multiple. So quite a lot of certainly most of my patients have got more than one condition.
Right.
They have multiple medications. When people come into hospital as well, how do people decide which ward, you know, who should go onto a ward that is where the consultant is a geriatrician as opposed to a cardiologist or a respiratory physician? And again, they're a group that the nurses know who need our help. And so often it's people who may be confused, who may already have some problems with memory, but don't have problems with memory until now. They've got an infection or something. And got complicated medication regimes. And a lot of my patients will be frail. So there'll be people who need help at home, whose families are beginning to pick up things for them, or who have, you know, formal carers coming in. So that's another thing that's lovely about the specialty. It's a very team-based specialty. There are a lot of people involved.
And working right across then, presumably physical ailment and mental.
Absolutely, exactly that. So, in this specialty, you have to think about every aspect of somebody's life. It's not just about getting their heart right. It's about thinking about what their walking's like, whether they're steady on their feet, whether they're going to be able to take all these fancy medicines that you've chosen for them. Mm. Actually, it's going to be a step too far. How are they going to manage when they get home? So it's about more than just treating the immediate condition in front of you.
Mm. And are there stereotypes that persist to do with the elderly and the frail that perhaps we need to unpack here?
That's a good question. And yes, there definitely are. And in fact, there's a whole debate to be had about the language that we use. Right. So, for example, older people, we tend to say older people and we tend not to say the elderly, because older people don't really like all being called the elderly, and because they're not all one collective group of people, they're all individual people. There are stereotypes, there are phrases that just pop up the whole time. One of my favourite, and all geriatricians would recognise it, is the fiercely independent. You know, we say, oh, this lady, she's fiercely independent. Yeah. What does that actually mean?
Yes. Shouldn't we all be fiercely independent?
Exactly. But it usually suggests that it's somebody who won't take your advice. So it comes with a note of frustration. But of course, in fact, we all would want to be fiercely independent as we get older.
It sounds as though there's a lot of sort of sensitivity around the language that's used, and also the way you talk to people. And I know you've written about this in your book, about how to better talk to people who are older.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think a lot of older people have had experience of being inadvertently patronised. The people calling them dear or calling them by their first name. I'm driven absolutely nuts by the fact that a lot of older people don't mind at all being called by their first name, provided you get that name right. And lots of older people are not actually called by their first name. They're called by their middle name. My husband is called by his middle name. My stepfather is called by his middle name. But if you go anywhere near a hospital, nobody ever asks. They always assume that the name at the front of your name is the one that you're going to be called by. And I've made that mistake plenty of times. So just getting people's name right is a good step in the right direction. And then, yes, it's so easy to... my aunt the other day had a difficult time at a hospital appointment, and somebody apologised to her and said, "Oh, I'm sorry you were upset." And she said, "I wasn't upset, I was incandescent." It made me sound as though I was some... You know, she's 91, but she wasn't upset, she was furious.
Yeah.
It's easy to get it wrong, and it's usually easy to get it right.
Yes, good. Well, you've got lots of hints and tips for us, which are so front of mind at the moment. And I think with so much focus having been on care homes, perhaps, and coping with loneliness.
Yes.
And the sense of despair amongst so many who are older.
Yes.
What's your advice there?
It's such a big...
That's a big question, sorry.
Yes. And I wrote this book really before COVID, and although I have put some pieces in about COVID, it is very important. But actually, all the things that are important about being older now were already important before, and loneliness and isolation is pretty near the top of the list. And the way that our society is structured so that people are increasingly isolated is something that we really need to get hold of, because this is not right. And it's not only older people that are disadvantaged, but actually the rest of us are too. If we don't include older people in our lives, we're missing out on a great wealth of knowledge and experience and funny stories. And, yes, you know, it's insane to do that. So when we come through this situation, I think it'll be very interesting to see how we tackle that. But while we're in it, what can individuals do? I think simply picking up the phone, using technology, learning to use technology, not being afraid of it, using FaceTime is just magical. I love watching someone's face when they work out they can see their grandchildren on FaceTime.
Yes.
And being neighbourly and knocking on someone's door and just making sure... Mm. Through saying, are you okay? Just remembering that. And there's lots that we can do that are just little steps towards making people included.
Mm-hmm.
Before COVID, of course, there were wonderful things happening, and lots of good organisations are still working really hard to make sure that people are not isolated. And we need to keep the momentum of that work. That's going to be very important.
A lot of people obviously are caring for elderly members of the family at home. So, you know, and that obviously brings its own challenges. What are the sort of early warning signs that somebody may be beginning to slip into cognitive decline? What are the sort of the worries that we perhaps, you know, I classify myself as a sort of midlife woman with older parents.
Yep.
And I'm always interested to know what we should be looking for, the early warning signs, if you like.
Yes. Okay. And I think a lot of people, I mean, I'm in the same situation, are in midlife with, it's a crucible really, isn't it? It's older parents, it's a job that's busy, and it's children who may or may not have left home but are needing all kinds of interesting support, and then who knows what's going on with your other half, etc. You know, there's so much to think about.
Been there, big time.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very familiar situation. And so thinking about, I think it's that's a good question, and I'd bring it back to an example. So what often happens is, say, sort of Joan's family might start picking things up, noticing that bills aren't being paid, and they just say, "Oh, Mum, let's set up a direct debit for that one; it'd be easier." Or noticing that maybe the house isn't as tidy as it was, or that there are accidents in the car, and driving is a really big one. And those can be early warning signs. And I teach my medical students, they always think that signs of cognition are things like forgetting, you know, what your name is and whether you've had lunch and things like that and how to get to the loo. And of course, those things do happen, but actually they happen very, very late in dementia. What we start noticing is, I say, it's the sort of things that my teenage children are learning. So how to drive, how to plan holidays, how to plan to see your friends. You might notice that a parent isn't making any social arrangements anymore. Mm. They're maybe becoming a little bit more isolated, maybe a bit less interested in how the world is working. And those aren't disastrous signs on their own, but they're just little warning signals that you might need to start thinking about whether this is a problem or actually whether somebody may be becoming depressed. That's a common condition, and it's often overlooked.
And is that because we sort of are genetically going to get more depressed as we age?
No. The really lovely thing is that it looks as though we get happier as we get older.
Okay. So why is that? Because we don't notice so much what's going on around us.
Yes, it's really interesting. It's studies from all over the world show that you're pretty happy in your 20s. You get a bit less happy as you go through some difficult patches in 30s and 40s. And in the UK, the sort of nadir, the bottom end of happiness is when you're about 49. And then after that, everything starts picking up, and it looks as though at least to the age of 75 you go on getting happier, and it's very,
very encouraging news. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's good. And actually, even people into their 80s and 90s are often a great deal happier than younger people would imagine them to be. So we make judgments about people's quality of life, and we base it on what we ourselves think. You know, I wouldn't want to be sitting in my house all day and not going out very often. Actually, if you ask somebody older how they regard themselves, they're happy. They're not everybody's happy, but a lot of people are actually very happy, contented. And so this gloomy picture, this bleak picture of old age is all wrong.
Very, really interesting and really encouraging too. You mentioned there earlier about accidents while driving.
Mm.
Is there a time when we might perhaps need to have that very difficult conversation with a parent?
Yes. And it's a conversation. Yeah. Yes, it absolutely is. And it can be a conversation you need to have more than once. Mm. So you may end up only having it once because there's been a defining incident, an accident, which means that they really need to stop, or they've had a medical condition diagnosed, which means they're not allowed to drive anymore. But much more commonly, there's a problem of just becoming a bit less good at it, and judgment being a little bit impaired and reflexes being slower. And this is in people who are otherwise doing very nicely and fine. And so that can be really awkward. And we have to be careful about what kind of standards we set people. So it is a tricky one. To be fair, most older people know themselves when they ought to stop driving. So actually, most people hang up their car keys at the right moment. It does get a bit more tricky when it's someone who really doesn't. Mm-hmm.
And how would you broach the subject? Would you sort of go out for a drive with them and be talking?
Yes, I've got lovely friends who...
You know, did you notice this? And
yes, and so that can be a nice way of doing it without making it be a test.
Mm.
Because it's not fair to put pressure on. But I've got lovely friends who've done that with their parents, just sat quietly in the car and keep quiet, don't give directions, but just see what's happening. And that can be a real confidence boost. You know, if you get to the supermarket and back and you're able to say, actually, Mum, I think you're fine, that's a lovely thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
But sometimes people are more tricky than that. And, you know, if a car is covered in dents and bruises, you think, we need to have a conversation.
You could involve your local GP, could you, to have a conversation?
I've written about this quite carefully in the book, because that is a common misconception that GPs are going to be able to tell somebody to stop driving. That actually isn't the case, apart from for a few clearly defined medical conditions, like, you know, you're not allowed to drive for a defined period after a stroke, for example, but then you may be able to drive. Or with visual impairment, there is some very clear guidance about exactly how much vision you need to be able to drive. And the DVA sets those rules. For the sort of less obvious things, like people who are just getting a a little bit of mild cognitive impairment, actually GPs are not in an easy position there. They can give some advice, but nobody has to take it.
Right.
So that is quite difficult. And the other thing is that they're bound by confidentiality rules, and the rules of confidentiality are, well, it's guidance rather than rules, but it's pretty good guidance, and you don't go around it. Right. So we do really respect people's confidentiality, and we have to do that. So actually, often the best people to have a conversation with somebody about their driving, it is the family, and the family can report somebody to the DVLA. If you absolutely have to, that's the way forward.
Really?
You can do that anonymously. And actually, in my experience, the DVLA are fantastic. They're very, very fair. They will arrange for somebody to be assessed if there's enough concern, and people can access a very fair driving assessment.
Oh, that's really interesting. I had no idea that you could do that. That's really encouraging, and to be able to do that anonymously as well. So,
yes,
kind of playing the bad guy.
Yes, exactly. So it's not, I mean, I would certainly say have the conversation first. Mm. Try have an agreement about it, much easier. But for the odd person where you're really stuck and they are absolutely not listening, then that can be the way around it.
Really, yeah, really practical advice. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Talking about cognitive impairment, can you clarify for me and maybe for others listening the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Ah, okay, yes. So dementia in itself isn't really a single illness. It's a collection of symptoms, and that can include problems with memory, but also organisational skills and orientation, you know, knowing where you are and so on. So lots of different things. And there are actually lots of illnesses that can cause dementia, and Alzheimer's is the number one of those. So the second one is vascular dementia, which happens when you've had little tiny strokes and bits of the, or one big bad stroke, and bits of the brain that are to do with thinking rather than with moving are affected. And quite a lot of people have both a bit of Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia. And then there are quite a lot of other sorts of dementia as well. So I think people quite often think of Alzheimer's disease as being this particularly terrible kind of illness where people really have no ability to look after themselves. That isn't the case. An awful lot of people who've got Alzheimer's disease are living very happy, normal lives, maybe with some support from family, still very active, still engaged in lots and lots of activities, including cognitive activities. And so it's it really covers a very broad range of conditions.
And are there different ways to treat Alzheimer's and dementia?
Yes, there are. The really sad thing is that we haven't yet got good medication for Alzheimer's disease, and I think everybody knows that. And it's there will be, but there isn't yet. But there are some medications that are licensed in Alzheimer's disease, and for a lot of people early on in the illness, I think they are worth trying, and that's one of the reasons why it probably is worth knowing that, you know, to get the diagnosis right. Mm-hmm. For some people, those tablets can make a lot of difference. For most people, they make a very little difference. And for some people, they make absolutely no difference at all.
Right.
And they also don't work forever. So, you know, they are not by no means a panacea. But the other important thing on the journey towards a dementia diagnosis is making sure that it's not something else. People often jump to a conclusion and think, oh, you know, that must be Alzheimer's, and it's a very easy label to put on somebody's notes or for a family to think. And then actually you do a bit more work and you think, actually, that's not what it is. This is something treatable.
I've come across actually many women in older life going through menopause have said to me, I was convinced that I was with dementia because my estrogen levels were plummeting in my brain.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't remember things. My cognitive function was so impaired.
Oh, that so happened to me. Absolutely. I couldn't find the word. I mean, I'm still not brilliant at finding the words, but, you know, every time you want one, you just have to send somebody out to find that word. But yes, absolutely. And that, yeah, okay. Well, we won't talk about HRT, but for me, that made a big difference.
Well, you know, I'm a massive fan. I mean, you have to prize it out of my dying hand, I tell you. It's really interesting to look. I mean, this is a sort of side segue, but it's interesting to look at the impact of estrogen on brain health.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of interesting studies now going on, particularly with Alzheimer's and estrogen.
Yes. I mean, and at the moment, I don't think there's enough evidence to say that we should all be taking it. And I certainly wouldn't feel guilty about not taking HRT. And I've got lots of fantastic friends who don't, and they look $1 million and they seem to be doing very nicely and they're very brainy, but for some people it definitely makes a difference.
Yeah, interesting. Really interesting. Anything else that we should be doing to help? You know, we talk about medication, but, you know, do you encourage doing crossword puzzles
and Sudokus as well? Yes, the thing about doing Sudokus, if you do lots of Sudokus, you get very good at Sudokus. What is interesting is that doing a variety of things definitely makes a difference. And so trying to keep active, I often say do more, not less. And that's advice I've had from patients. You know, this idea that you should sort of slide into your slippers when you've retired and sit and watch the golf all day. Absolutely not. So keeping, it's in a way, it's a bit like having a varied diet.
Yeah.
It's have a varied life, do different things, read a different book. You know, buy yourself a different newspaper once a week. And
from a different point of view, that's really interesting. You can really annoy yourself by reading a newspaper.
Exactly. Drive yourself mad by talking to somebody you disagree with.
Yes,
that kind of thing is tremendous. I mean, another silly thing, but actually really important, is if you've got hearing problems, try and get them sorted out.
Yeah.
Because I think we've almost noticed during lockdown, I don't know about you, but I think a lot of people have felt their intellectual faculties reducing as our interactions have reduced. And in a way, that's a parallel with losing hearing. You are just not picking up as much that is exciting.
Yeah. Well, our world has sort of shrunk, hasn't it? Yeah. As we're not travelling, and for many of us, it's literally shrunk to the kind of the four walls that we're in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, if I ring a friend who is hard of hearing, it's very difficult, because it's very difficult for them to hear. And I think it's lovely that we've got technology like we're using now, where we can actually see each other.
Yes.
And it has actually got simpler, hasn't it? I mean, I know in the old days, sort of computers and things would be really hard. But with a tablet, you just press a button and there you are. It is relatively simple, hopefully, for most people.
Yes, and lots of older people have engaged brilliantly with that. It's not for everyone, and we mustn't overlook the fact that people are missing physical contact so desperately.
Absolutely right. Oh my goodness. I remember talking to somebody a while back, talking about the power of touch and saying, you know, three hugs a day, that's my prescription for everybody. You know, hug somebody three times a day minimum. And you think, well, where has that gone? I mean, and if you're
living on your own.
I was talking to a physio recently who said she touched somebody who hadn't been touched for, well, since the end of March. Had not had a physical hand on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not devastating. I agree. And actually, I was reading the audio book of the book and realised how often I talk about touching my patients or touching a family member when we're in a situation where somebody needs comfort or... There's a scene where I'm terribly cross about something and somebody else, the touch of someone else just brings me back into being able to think clearly about a problem that has become very emotional.
Yeah. God, now talking about that obviously leads into the inevitable questions about how we deal with really difficult discussions. We're talking about end of life.
Yes.
And, you know, we're so good, aren't we, about talking about birth and, you know, the joyful things. But I think, is it they say that death and taxes are the only two unavoidable things in life?
Yep.
And yet we simply don't talk about death.
We would rather do our...
to avoid it.
Yeah, we do. We'd rather do our tax return than talk to mum about it.
Do you have those conversations?
Yes, all the time, Liz. And what I have learned, and this is really partly, I mean, I've written the book about life and there's lots in it about the enjoyment of life and maintaining joy and happiness and independence in life. But I don't want to shy away from the conversations about the end, because if we get the end right, oh my golly, it makes everything so much better. And having conversations makes the end go well. And I've just seen it over and over again, how a family or an older person themselves, this burden is lifted off their shoulders in these conversations. And if you can have one of these difficult conversations, they are frightening things to think about, but I'm thinking about a patient of mine, Betty, who was really independent and well, and her daughters had told me how fantastic she was, still driving and so on. And she had a stroke out of the blue. It was really sad, a horrible big stroke. And she wasn't ever going to be able to speak again. And there was wasn't able to communicate what she wanted. And there was a conversation about whether we should be feeding her by tube because she wasn't able to swallow anymore. And what was really lovely in that situation was that she had addressed that with her daughters and she'd sat them down. In fact, several times she'd mentioned it. She hadn't written it down, but she'd had a really good, honest conversation about what she would and wouldn't want. And it was just one of those situations where those two women looked at one another and they said, we know what mum's on this. And
so at what stage should we be having those conversations then?
So that is a good question. My feeling is that actually, if we could normalise them, we would have them more often and more easily. Mm. But if family that's in that situation, also, I think the other important thing is older people quite often would like to have that conversation, but they don't know how to start it either.
Right.
So having the right words to start that conversation is a good place to start. And then often it's a little hint of something happens, and it may be an illness that an older person has or a fall or something, or often it's the death of a spouse or of a friend, or a friend moving into care, or something on television, or anything can prompt a conversation. And the key thing is not to duck it. If that moment appears, just don't duck it. And you know, I watch sometimes, you know, even somebody really, really frail in hospital, like, you know, I'm thinking of Pat the other day, and her granddaughter's visiting, and Pat is so fragile. And she said, oh, I don't think I'm going to see my next birthday. And this granddaughter, so sweet, and leans in and puts her hand on her and says, oh, Nan, don't speak like that. You'll be fine. And she just, it's so instinctive to protect somebody. But actually better not to. Better to say, oh, that's a sad thought. But maybe you're right. Perhaps we should talk about that. fantastic.
Opening, isn't it?
Yes.
And also absolutely. When things happen to other people. Mm. I had a family member who had a massive stroke and was then on life support and sadly died. And it did actually start the conversation. Well, what if that was me? What if that was yes. you? What would you want to happen? Because yes. the big questions about, you know, is the machine turned off? What do we do? You know, and you can then start playing out various scenarios, can't you?
Yes, absolutely. And I think they do require courage, these moments. And again, it's something that I have given some practical advice about what kind of form of words you can use if you need to have that conversation. You even start thinking about it in your own head. And also, what, you know, do you need to write it down? Do you need a lawyer? No, you don't. But, you know, where can you get some advice? How do you make sure that if you've got some very firm views, how do you make sure that they're recorded? But actually, you know, it isn't really about recording things and getting them written down in a very important, you know, very clear format. Actually, it's just having the conversation that's the really good start. And that it's every time I think about it, I can just picture time and again someone who is relieved, patients yeah. and families, and they are relieved to have those conversations.
That's really good to know. That's really encouraging, I think, for anybody who's thinking, gosh, this is a conversation that I need to have. What about things like living wills and DNR?
Yes. Okay.
I mean, are they real things? Are they things that you deal with in your work?
Absolutely. Yes, very much. They're more spoken about than actually present. So the other thing is that we get ourselves in a complete tangle of nomenclature. So we talk about advanced care plans, and we talk about treatment escalation plans, and we talk advanced decisions to refuse treatment, and we talk about advanced statements. And they are all really important subjects, and we get in a complete muddle about what each of them are. You know, which one's a living will, which one is legally binding, which one isn't, which one's just about what music you'd like to have if you were unwell, and which one is about what treatment you'd like to have, which is a completely different thing. So it is important to have some understanding, and it's very easy for people to get a bit flawed, actually. You know, you think, okay, I want to make some plans. How do I do it? Where am I supposed to write it?
And what's legal? I mean, presumably you're covering this in your book with ideas of where to go and templates. And, you know, I guess for all of us, because death is a certainty, it's kind of a thing that almost at any age, or certainly from your middle years onwards, it's not a bad idea, is it? Just to jot down, should the worst happen, you know, the proverbial bus comes along and I don't make it home, or I make it home but in a vegetative state, what would I actually want to happen?
Absolutely, Liz. I think it's very interesting that some people, I mean, I've written mine down and spoke some time ago, because it isn't really about me, it's about my family. And I don't want them to be in a situation in which they're making, frankly, agonising decisions, desperate.
What a really great way of looking at it. And, you know, when you are thinking about that as a very sad thing, you know, potentially as a situation that you might find yourself in, but actually to be thinking, okay, how can I make this better?
Yes.
Everybody else in my family, by actually taking the decision to do this now. And maybe actually that's a way to bring up a conversation with somebody who's older.
Yes.
By saying, absolutely, I've done this because this is a really important thing for the family. You know, have you had any thoughts about it?
Yes, exactly. And it is that shared experience. And so in the book, I use quite a lot of stories about my patients and their families and how they have individually approached these. So it's not just a kind of list of here's the guidance and this is what you do and you need to sign it and date it and witness it. It isn't like that. I do cover the practicalities and the GMC guidance and what the law says and things like that. So I explain those, but I also very much use individual stories to illustrate how families have sorted these things out. They are emotional conversations. We can't get away from that. And that is what makes them so difficult to talk about. So it's this bizarre combination of, because you're talking with somebody you love, you can't because you love them too much. You can't talk about something awful happening.
Yes.
Because you love them, it's the most important conversation.
It is, isn't it? How can we make death better, do you think?
Talking about it is a very good place to start, and realizing that death done well, and lots of people do death very, very well. I think a lot of families have had experience of someone's departure being peaceful and actually being beautifully done, and they have very warm memories of a really good death. So, but that's not true for everyone. I think it is almost always better if you've made some kind of plan. And that means that the people that are there can respect your wishes and can do what you would have wanted. And you've heard that expression. People say, oh, it's what Dad would have wanted.
Yeah.
Going like that. Oh, that's the way he would have wanted. It's a lovely thing to be able to say. But you can only say it if you know what he would have wanted.
Yes. And I guess in all of this, there's also joy. You talked earlier about joy and happiness being covered in the book as well, and celebrating that joyfulness and that longevity, yes, which hopefully we all aspire to.
Yes, and we should. And that's the other thing, is I think that for some reason, well, for many reasons, old age is often framed in this very bleak framework, and we talk about the finances and the economy and carers and the rest of it, and we forget that actually, it's fantastic. Yeah. Have years in retirement is a real bonus. People didn't have 100 years ago. They retired and died. And now you have this lovely period, if you're lucky, and most people are, you have this amazing period after you've retired where you can do things that you're interested in. You can spend time with your friends and your family. You can watch grandchildren grow up. You can go and join the local history society, or go and watch ducks, and you can do whatever you want to do. And we forget about that. And instead we've got all this hand-wringing, and we shouldn't have hand-wringing. We should be saying, this is fantastic. How are we going to make it as good as it can possibly be?
Yeah, how fortunate. It is always, it's looking at the positives, isn't it? And just being grateful for those extra years, and, you know, perhaps mindful of those that haven't had them.
Yes.
And celebrating that.
Yeah.
See, thank you so much. It was such an interesting, and I know it will have been for many, a really thought-provoking conversation. And your book is so important. I wish you huge success with it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Liz. I have really enjoyed just being allowed to talk with you. It's been a treat.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's episode. As always, you will find all the links and the resources that we mentioned on today's show over on lizellewellbeing.com. There you can sign up for the free weekly newsletter that's filled with plenty more expert information about living and aging well. Huge thanks to all of you, as always, who leave us such lovely reviews, especially on iTunes. It really does help others to find the show and widen the net. So until the next time we chat, go well. Bye-bye. The Liz Earle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Liz Earle, with production by Amaryllis Earle and Harry Trevithick at Heart Dialogue, with thanks to my producer, Ellie Smith, guest booker, Millie de la Morinière, and assistant researcher, Martha Comerford.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.